Welcome to the Virtual Center for the Study of the Constitution and Civic Responsibility, an ongoing inquiry into American political origins and evolving political and social and cultural institutions. The Executive Director of the Virtual Center is Dr. Bill O'Brien. He's also your host for this conversation. Here he is now, Dr. Bill O'Brien.
Thank you, Bob Kincaid, and welcome everyone to the Virtual Center for the Study of the U.S. Constitution and Civic Responsibility on this Tuesday. It is the 25th day of February. It is sunny and cold here. It looks like we are on the cusp of yet another polar vortex. I don't think it's going to be quite as severe as the one we had in January, but new word, new experience. It's a winter that will, it just doesn't seem to want to quit, does it? I welcome you to the program. I encourage you to participate actively in the program. Our phone number is area code 304-658-3333. If you'd like to communicate directly with me on some of the issues, my email address is waobrien906@gmail.com. That's waobrien906@gmail.com. I wanted to, first of all, let me open with an announcement that tomorrow we will be beginning 1 hour early, excuse me, here at the Virtual Center. I have a meeting, excuse me, tomorrow at 5:30. Tomorrow at 5:30 in the evening, so I'm going to have to be off the air by 5. So we will be going 1 hour earlier tomorrow, 3 to 5. And for those of you who listen in real time, that's kind of a very important thing. Because I can imagine when you tune it in and you think you're there for the beginning and you find out there's already been an hour that you missed, that's kind of defeating, and I don't want anybody to experience that. So kind of mark it down if you are so inclined to do so. Excuse me, that tomorrow's programs will begin 1 hour earlier, which is 3 p.m. here in the East. Again, the numbers are the same. Everything else is the same. 304-658-3333 and email waobrien906@gmail.com. Before we went on the air today, I was having a short conversation with Bob Kincaid about yesterday's program, and especially about his participation in the program. For those of you who were able to tune in yesterday, Bob joined us about 15 minutes after the hour in the second hour and was with us for most of that hour, a good 40 to 45 minutes. And what I thought was some of the most enlightening and insightful conversation I've had in a long time. I don't say this because I have a lot of respect for Bob Kincaid and Bob's insight or intelligence or anything else. But the particular subject is one that I knew going into the program yesterday is kind of in Bob's wheelhouse. It's something he feels very passionately about. I knew that. And when he finally said he felt like he was summoned, in a point way he was, because I kind of thought that he might call and might join us in the conversation. And he even today was a little bit apologetic about it, and I tried to encourage him to know that he should never be. First of all, he should not, because I really believe, and I still believe, that the kind of conversation that we have yesterday really is the road to real understanding and real learning. Because I really have the feeling that when you engage other people in a topic like this, which is education, we'll get back to it in a moment. I think if you go into it with the idea that you have very, very strong feelings and a very clear idea as to where you want to go. But on the other hand, when you encounter people passionate in the same interests as you do, it seems to me very important that you begin to recognize that there's an opportunity for you to learn here as well as other people to learn here. And that's what I experienced yesterday. I felt that I got more out of that conversation yesterday than I possibly could have just by going through what I was planning to go through without that conversation. And what I hoped, and I shared this with Bob, is that I hope others out there would feel more inclined as a result of the program yesterday to feel comfortable calling and sharing their ideas and their perceptions on some of this stuff. Because I think the ultimate goal is the same. We're all headed in the same direction. We're all looking for the same things. And that's greater understanding, a richer appreciation for some of the issues that we've been talking about. And I think, and I've said this many times, and I don't want to say it too many times, but there clearly is something about the audience that tunes in regularly to the Head On Radio Network and or to the Virtual Center for the Study of the Constitution on the Head On Radio Network. We're obviously dealing with people who have an awful lot to contribute to the general community's understanding about some of these issues. So I don't ever want anyone to feel reticent or uncomfortable about calling. I'm not the type of a person, personally or psychologically or any other way, that is ever going to in any way indicate to people that their opinions and their ideas are not welcome in this discussion. If I ever did that, then it would be time to curtail the discussion and look for something else to keep me busy, because the whole purpose of this is education and learning. And to assume that one or more or a few people have exclusive access to information or truth or else is contrary to everything that I believe about education. And I hope it's pretty much counter to some of the things that you believe as well. So again, I trust and I encourage you to feel comfortable picking up the phone and giving us a call on some of these issues, especially issues related to education, because all of us have had such an extensive experience in education, if nothing else, as students. Many of us are parents. Many have learned about what it takes to successfully raise or try to raise children, and to try to guide them and direct them and hopefully implant within them some of the wisdom and some of the insights, some of the things that we've learned, in order that they'll be able to avoid some of the mistakes that we made. All of us have had these kinds of experiences. So the fact of the matter is, all of us have something to bring to the table here from the get-go. So again, if you are inclined to participate or buy in or whatever, please feel comfortable to do so. We would love to hear from you and love to have you. The issue here, the issue that we began yesterday and the one that I'd like to pursue today, is this whole issue of educational reform. It is so important. We've been back to it over and over again. We spent time justifying it as having a proper place and a proper role here at the Virtual Center. And I hope that we've pretty well established that as a given. But as I mentioned yesterday, I was very struck by Tom Friedman's piece in Sunday's New York Times, which was an interview that he conducted at Google on how to get a job at Google. In other words, what Google is looking for in the candidates it hires. And I think all of us recognize, I kind of maybe assumed it going in, and I shouldn't have done that, but the very mere fact that Google is mentioned in this article on the op-ed page of the New York Times by one of the world's most prominent columnists suggests that if you ask around and check around, there's absolutely no question that there's nobody that doesn't recognize that in today's world, being hired by Google is about the best opportunity as far as a career path is concerned that anybody could possibly hope for. Google is considered, you know, one of the best two or three companies, if not the very best in the world to work for. And so consequently, the competition to make a good impression with Google, if you were indeed are so fortunate as to even get an interview, the competition is keen. And those who are successful and are hired by Google are to be commended, because I think what it suggests is you've met a pretty rigorous competition and you've somehow been able to prevail. So I think that going in, I think we need to recognize that that's the operative assumption here, that getting a job at Google is the same as getting it everywhere else. It's something very special in the world of employment, at least in today's world. It's very obvious then that whatever we can learn from the world's premier employer in this digital age is something that all of us need to pay special attention to. Obviously, all of us want to know what it is they're looking for. Because even if, as is true for almost all of us, only, you know, there are only a very few of us that will ever get to work for Google, probably. But if we are able to add to our repertoire some of the ingredients that Google's looking for, then it's clearly going to be a benefit to us as we continue to seek career opportunities in a very, very challenging, digital, highly competitive world. And so I guess what I'm saying is Google has a lot to tell us. And in a society like the United States today, where jobs are at such a premium, the criteria used by the best to hire people is something all of us need to pay special attention to. That's one reason I found the article so very, very important. But as I think our conversation, Bob's conversation with me yesterday indicated, there's so much in this article, there's so much involved in understanding and being familiar with the kinds of criteria that Google is looking for, that it seems to me all of us can benefit from and learn from this kind of an experience. So I think our time here at the Virtual Center is indeed well spent by looking at this particular article, and then going from it, assuming that we are able to get through the bulk of the article today, and then moving directly into the Virtual Center in terms of its educational mission and the extent of which the Virtual Center is envisioned, at least, as a way to begin to tap in to some of the educational initiatives and reform prospects that are liable to give more people greater opportunity in coming to the attention of Google. I think, and I've said this before, and I want to get into this because really looking for your input as we begin to articulate in very, very specific language some of the principles of the Virtual Center here, so we can put it up on a website, which I hope will not be long in coming. I really do respect your insight and your as participants in this experience. More than anybody else, you know from having listened to this program for however many months we've been on, as to what the ultimate goal of the Virtual Center is. But when it comes to education, I've tried and hopefully been somewhat successful at least in indicating where I think education has been deficient and where I think education needs to go in order to better prepare more people for the challenges of 21st century employment. I think our conversation yesterday was right on the mark in terms of those kinds of abilities and those kinds of skills. So again, if you'll permit me, for those listening who maybe weren't with us yesterday, I'd like to spend the first couple of moments at least looking at, again, the very initial sentences and paragraphs of this article, and then getting to the third paragraph, which is where we got yesterday in our second hour when we were talking about coding and about translation and the whole issue of language and foreign language and the structure of language and all the rest of it. I think all of it is very, very important. And this is kind of a review of the conversation that Bob and I had yesterday. There's absolutely no question that we have allowed a major element in providing for students an opportunity to learn and develop, to experience the skills that Google is looking for in candidates today. The opportunity was there when citizens were much more amenable to the value and the idea of foreign languages in a curriculum. But over time, a substantial amount of time, we seemingly have allowed people who have put the priorities of career and efficiency and cost and all the rest of it in the forefront of our educational priorities, to the point that we have listened to and fallen for, I believe, the argument that in today's world, people can't afford the luxury of studying foreign languages, is we can't afford much longer to go without some sort of return to the benefits and the value of foreign language. It's not any specific language. I can remember debates going on about Latin being a dead language and the idea that what we needed to do is spend our time, if we're going to spend time with a foreign language, we need to spend that time on a language that is useful and that can benefit us. During the last half of the 20th century, when the situation with international communism was at its peak, when the Cold War was at its height, people believed that Russian was kind of the language of the future. Recently, the language of choice, so to speak, has become Chinese, has become Mandarin Chinese, because of the trade and commercial potential of China's role in a developing world. On the other hand, some people have begun to look at Spanish as the language of choice because of the increasing proportion of Hispanic Americans that make up the citizenry of the United States in the 21st century. But I think the conversation that Bob and I had yesterday indicated that while he and I both believe that Latin is a critical asset in understanding the structure of language, especially since, as Bob pointed out yesterday, 70% of the words, 70% of the vocabulary that we currently entertain in our English language has Latin roots. And so one's understanding of vocabulary is benefited by the study of Latin. But I think the conversation yesterday was focusing on the less obvious value of the process of translating from one language into another. And in the process of doing that, the sense of understanding and appreciation and respect for language itself that comes from that. How ideas are expressed and communicated to other people. Looking at various ways to express a thought or an idea, and recognizing that some ways of communication are much more effective than others. Recognizing that there is kind of an ideal or a best way to organize and structure communication in order to make it much more effective. And the way you measure that effectiveness is by the degree of understanding on the other end. I'm reminded of the adage, and I've been into this many, many times in a lot of different texts, where people say, well, so-and-so is misinterpreting what I'm saying. I didn't mean what he or she thinks I mean by what I said. This is my intent was this, not that. And the reality is that communication theory suggests to us that communication is not what is sent, but what is received. The key in communication is not what you mean to say or write, but what people on the other end believe you said or wrote. You can't unsay things. Once you push that send button on the computer, it's gone. You can't take it back. So consequently, you better be sure that what you said is what you wanted to say, and the way you said it is the way you wanted it received. So much of the problems that we have in our world today, whether they be on a national or international level, or whether they be within a household itself, so much of the problems that we encounter today are based on miscommunication and misunderstanding. That's not what you said. This is what you said. Well, that may be what you heard me saying, but this is what I meant. And so I think one of the things that came across in our conversation yesterday is the fact that recognizing and appreciating, understanding language, and understanding that there is a best way to translate and communicate understanding from one language to the other. That's a skill that, with the demise of foreign languages in our curriculum, that's a skill that we have allowed to fall through the cracks. This is the same skill that Google is looking for in its candidates. The difference is Google is focusing on a very, very specific version of that skill. They are looking for the translation that we call coding, which is taking language or data, information, whatever it is you need to communicate, and transposing it into a format that is necessary to get it onto the internet so that other people can receive it. That's what the world of the digital world that we live in today is all about. That's the technology we've been talking about. That's where the jobs of today and tomorrow are. So the one thing that ought to kill anybody should be going around saying, and in my years in higher education advising students on curriculum, I used to hear this. I've heard it recently over and over again from students. I really don't know what to major in. And I almost have to shrug my shoulders and say, if you don't know what to major in, you're not alive. It's pretty obvious where the greatest opportunities are going to be. Earlier today, in a senior citizens class I teach, we were looking at the same subject in discussion this morning. And one of the people there happens to work in a local hospital here. And they were talking about coding in terms of medical coding, which is transposing data that comes from tests, blood pressure tests and temperature and all of those things, and coding those things into medical language in order to get it on the permanent, on your permanent record. In a smaller way, it's the same process. And I think that the more experience and the more familiar we can be with that process, the greater our understanding and appreciation for what's involved in that process. And consequently, the better at it we would become. Whether it's translating from one foreign language into another, or whether it's translating from data to the internet, to a website, or whatever. Obviously, there are very, very specific skills associated with that. It's very like, very much like studying foreign languages and having to learn a new vocabulary, a totally new vocabulary. Well, in technology, there is its own vocabulary, its own language. Bob mentioned one of the languages yesterday, C++. I will admit, I've heard of C++, and I have talked to a number of people that talk about it and its value, math teachers. But I'm totally unfamiliar with C++. Obviously, Bob is not. But the point is, that's the direction that we need to go, and the skill and the ability to get from one place to the other with that process is one that many of us had a long time ago and allowed ourselves to be talked out of because it didn't seem relevant. It didn't seem like we had the time. It seemed like a waste of time. Learning, real learning, is never a waste of time. I don't know how profound that statement is, but it's something that I really, again, as part of review, Will, of the little bit, we didn't much yesterday into the article, but a little bit we went into, if you remember, the article opens with Laszlo Bock, who is the Senior Vice President of People Operations at Google. He's the guy that does the hiring. He made the point that Google has found that grade point averages are really not very helpful as a criterion for hiring people. Test scores, he says, are worthless. They don't predict anything. At least anything that we need to know about a prospective employee. He also pointed out that a proportion of the people working for Google who do not have a college degree is higher than most people would expect. The figure he used was 14%. Obviously, given the technical nature of the job, it's pretty obvious that post-secondary education is required for most of these jobs. But the point that Bock is making is the kind of skills that Google is looking for are not exclusive to a college education. My concern, the reason I'm spending time here at the Virtual Center on this, is because it is my belief that these skills have to be part of a college education, even if they're not exclusive to a college education. Bock's point is that there are people who are able to pick up these skills in places other than the college classroom. And they're very aware of it, and they're very willing to accept it, and they're always in search of it. That doesn't mean that college is not worthwhile. It doesn't mean that college is not valuable. However, what it does mean is that the kind of things that Google is looking for better be included in a college education, and if they're not, then people better get about very quickly in making sure that they are included in college curriculum. Otherwise, Google will be forced to look for all of its employees outside the realm of the campus, of the higher education campus. So I think that's a relevant point. I spent a little bit of time on it yesterday. I don't want to necessarily beat it to death again. But my experience has indicated to me that so many students are so obsessed with grade point average. And let me tell you something else that I neglected to mention yesterday, but it's really part of that. As much respect as I have developed over the years for what we call non-traditional students, which are those adults that didn't go to college directly out of high school, but many of whom worked for a while, whether they just wanted to work to earn money, whether they ended up getting married and supporting a family or whatever. But a larger and larger proportion of the seats in today's college classrooms are being occupied by people who are older than the norm, older than the 18 or 19 year old graduate, 18 year old, 17 year old graduate out of high school going directly to college. And I have developed a tremendous respect for these people, especially people that are in the 30s and 40s and even 50s that go back to school, that suddenly decide or finally decide that there are things in this life that they still want to do and things that they still need to learn in order to do it. And I just respect the heck out of that. And I respect the people who take it on. But one of the things I've noticed about non-traditional students, older students who return to class, is that if it's even possible, they tend to be more obsessed with grade point average than anybody else. This is not a criticism. It's very understandable. But I think we have to consider it in light of what Laszlo Bock is telling us here for Google, in terms of the overall value that Google places on grade point average. From the perspective of most adults who are going back into the classroom, which where the majority of the students are obviously quite a bit younger than they are, they naturally feel, older students naturally feel, as being somewhat out of place. In other words, they aren't the norm, they are the exception in the classroom. And they're very aware of that. But part of that awareness is that if grade point average is the measure that people are going to use to define success, then who am I to question that? Then I need to make sure that my grade point average is an accurate measure or reflection of my abilities. And because non-traditional students, returning students, tend to take their education a lot more serious on average than students who go to college right out of high school, consequently, they would take the grade point average more seriously as well. It just stands to reason. And again, this isn't a criticism, but I think it's something that we need to be aware of. People who take their education more seriously obviously take more seriously the measures that are used to measure the effectiveness and the value of that education. You know, and very honestly, in most cases, non-traditional students are paying for their own education out of their own pocket, whereas many traditional age students are getting scholarships and financial aid from the government and various other things. And so consequently, it's not their nickel. So there's an inclination on the part of the younger students to not take education nearly as seriously as do those who are paying out of pocket, especially with the costs escalating the way they are. Bock makes the point, however, that good grades don't hurt, of course. since so many jobs at Google require mathematics, computing, and coding skills. If your good grades reflect those skills in the areas that matter to Google, then obviously they're going to be an advantage. If you've got a really solid grade point average in math and computer science and all the rest of it, that matters. Let's be realistic here. When he says that grade point averages, you know, doesn't measure anything and is not a key criterion in hiring, the fact of the matter is, if most of the competition that you have for the job you're applying for are coming with really superior grade point averages, then you better have one too. If there are 15 people applying for the same position and everybody has a 3.6, 3.8, a 4.0 grade point, and you've got a 2.0 grade point, then for you, grade point's going to matter because you're not going to even get a second look. Of course, the fact of the matter is with a 2.0 average, you wouldn't be called in for an interview anyway. So it seems to be one of those, it's not fair, I guess, but it's one of those things where it may not, your grade point average may not get you the job, but it can sure cost you the job. So, I worry a little bit about the obsession with grade point averages. And the reason for that, the reason I worry, is because some people are driven by grade point average more than the educational needs associated with it. I have talked to more students than I dare mention who have said to me over the years, I would like to major in history. I would like to major in the humanities. I would like to major in art. I would like to take classes in painting or theater. But I can't afford it. You can't get jobs in it. I got to get a job. So I can't afford to spend time and money on what society considers to be fluff. And so consequently, they end up taking classes and majoring in disciplines that they may not even like because they believe that there's a job at the other end. Oh, the number of people over the years that I have seen go into education and in the most private of moments, when they're being brutally honest, they will tell you they can't stand kids. And yet here they are majoring in education, and they're going to spend the bulk of their life with kids. And the argument, if you confront them on that, well, I know there are jobs. I know there's going to be a lot of teacher retirements, and there's going to be job openings, and I have to have a job. All I can think of is I hope my kid doesn't end up in your class. But then, this is where we stopped yesterday, where our conversation took off from, was Bach's mention of the fact that there are 5 hiring attributes that Google has across the company. If it's a technical role, he says, we assess your coding ability. And that, of course, we spent an awful lot of time yesterday on that idea of coding ability. And half the roles of the company are technical roles. So if it's a technical role and half of the jobs at Google are technical, then coding ability is critical. You not only need to be able to do it, you need to be good at it. And this is an issue that we didn't address yesterday. In today's competitive world, where some of the people that competing with us for jobs, coming from areas of the world that were never competitive before, but have become so with the advent of technology and the internet, we better be good at what we're doing. Bob yesterday in the conversation we had on the air was talking about people who go take computer classes and made reference to some of the things that the computer classes emphasize. How to do this, how to do that, how to use Microsoft Access, how to use word processing, how to do spreadsheets, how to do this, that, and the other thing. Every one of those skills is a process skill. It's a how-to skill. You do it, you know how to do it, and what defines all of them is that the data that you are working with or the information that you are working with is not your own, it's coming from somebody else. The real power, the real opportunity, the real challenges, the real jobs are the ones that control the data, not the ones who process it. And we have so many people who believe that if they take a basic computer class and they learn how to code or how to program or how to word process or how to surf the internet, or how to use Twitter, or how to access Facebook, that constitutes computer skills. That's not the kind of computer skills we're talking about. We're talking about something much more sophisticated and much deeper. And what that means is, when you enter this realm or this area, you better be good at it. The only way that I can make this real is to use myself as an example, and I'm not the best example. But even in history, I have had students say to me, "How did you learn all this stuff? How do you know all this stuff?" One day you're into economics, the next day you're into sociology, the next day you're into psychology, the next day you're into political history, the next day you're into geography. The next day you're looking at literature of some kind or another. You're looking at poems or something like that. How did you do this? And what they say is, you know, especially the people that really enjoy history, many of them will say, my goal is to learn as much history as you know. I wish I knew as much as you know. And my answer to that has to be, you don't want to learn as much as I know. You want to learn way more than I know. I want to know way more than I know. Where you need to be is where knowing what I know and using it to know more will take you. You can't be satisfied with getting an A on my test. That doesn't mean that you know history and understand and appreciate all the ins and outs and innuendos associated with history. That means that you can do and you've mastered what I've expected you to master in this class. But if you don't take that and use it to move forward, then there's no point in knowing what you know. The same principle would apply with computer skills. I can't speak from experience with computer skills because I don't have that many of them. But to go and sign up at a local VOTEC center or a local community college or something in order to take basic computer skills or computer 1 and computer 2 and learn about software, learn programs that other people have invented, other people have put together, learn how to use Access and how to use spreadsheets and how to use Microsoft Word processing and all the rest of it. That is not computer skills. All that is the basics that you need to know in order to learn. You can't be satisfied. If I'm teaching computer skills, you can't be satisfied to know what I know about computer skills. Because if I really knew what I needed to know about computer skills, I wouldn't be here teaching them to you. I'd be at Google. So you can't be satisfied with what I can teach you, because I can't teach you enough to get you into Google. And I think that's very important in our whole education system. We tend to look at grade points as a measure of how smart we are. What grade points really need to measure is your ability to keep on learning. And if you put too much of a focus on the grade point, it becomes an excuse to stop learning rather than an impetus to keep learning and learn more. So in this world where Google is looking for candidates, where half the jobs are technical jobs, and technical jobs require coding ability, for every job, Bach says, the number one thing we look for is general cognitive ability. And it's not IQ. It's learning ability. It's the ability to process on the fly. It's the ability to pull together disparate bits of information. Again, very, very important. Cognitive ability is the ability to pull together disparate pieces of information. To be able to take pieces of information, facts, data, whatever it happens to be, and find ways that they connect, even when those ways are not visible, are not obvious. Let me give you one example, and this is just an example that I can use because I happened to just write this question yesterday. But I spend a lot of time developing study questions for students in the class I teach. And what I do is I go through all the material that I'm asking them to read, the books, the documents, everything else. And out of those things, I formulate questions, every one of them focused on what a particular body of information means. Not what it says, what it means. And so, as an example, right now in the unit that I'm developing in the class of contemporary United States history class that we're studying now, the questions that I was putting together relate to the period from the end of World War I up into the 1920s, prior to the stock market crash of 1929 and the Great Depression, where we'll be going into Roosevelt's New Deal after that. And in the book of documents that students have in this course, there are a series of documents, all of them in a chapter, about what is called progressivism, which is the progressive liberal philosophy that was so prominent prior to World War I in the United States. And when we came out of World War I, the disillusionment because of the war caused people to turn their back on progressivism for a long time, until the stock market crashed and Roosevelt came in with the New Deal and gave renewal to the whole idea of a much more progressive, positive, liberal approach to problems. But anyway, the question that I was throwing at students was, you know, what I'm after, I want you to understand progressivism. So there were four documents in this book of readings. One of them was a document on written by Jane Addams on Hull House. Another one was an expose of Standard Oil, written by Arda Tarbell and appearing in McClure's magazine in the early 20th century. A third one was on the position of Eugene Debs, who emerged as a socialist in the early 20th century and ended up running as a candidate, a third-party candidate for President of the United States, and ended up in jail during World War I for violating the laws against civil liberties and free speech passed during the war. Anyway, there were four documents, all of them reflecting something about progressivism, whether it's Jane Addams and Hull House or whether it's Eugene Debs or whatever the document is. So the question that I asked is, looking at each of these four documents, write an essay on progressivism, a portion of which is revealed in each of these documents. In other words, how does each of these documents, how does each of these documents reflect or contribute to your over-understanding of what progressivism is all about? The point I'm making is that is an example of taking disparate pieces of information, things that don't seem to connect, and finding ways that they do connect. The burden of generating their own learning is on the students. I'm not telling them how they connect. I'm asking them to tell me how they connect, which means they have to do it. And so, in a sense, when Bach is telling Tom Friedman for this article that the general cognitive ability that Google is looking for is not IQ, it's learning ability. It's the ability to be able to take information and find ways how to connect it to the point that it creates new meaning.
Dr. Bill.
Bob, I'm sorry. I had the button pushed off.
Oh, okay.
I heard
you cough, and then I just wanted to...
I was coughing, and I pushed the button, and I forgot to push it back on. I'm so sorry. God, and I just made a super point, and I can't remember what it is.
Too many buttons. Well, would you like to go ahead and take the top of the hour break a few minutes early?
Why don't I do that? We've already broken, let's break.
All right, stand by.
We'll take 5 minutes. Thank you, Bob. You're listening to the Virtual Center for the Study of the Constitution. It is now 54 minutes after the hour. In 5 minutes, we'll be right back and we'll pursue our second hour. Please stay with us.
Thank you.
Now return to the Virtual Center for the Study of the Constitution and Civic Responsibility with your host, Dr. Bill O'Brien.
Thank you, Bob Kincaid, and welcome back to our second hour here at the Virtual Center. I have pushed the appropriate button, and I will do the very best I can to make sure that I don't go crazy pushing or not pushing buttons. I apologize for that, and I was rolling on here, and I didn't even realize that I wasn't even on the air, and I apologize for that. You are listening to the Virtual Center. This is our second hour. If you've been with us through the first hour, I appreciate your staying with us. If you are just joining us, welcome. We have returned to the article which appeared in Sunday's New York Times entitled How to Get a Job with Google, and we're looking rather intensively, I think, at some of the skills that Google looks for in its candidates. And again, what really drives this is Google is considered to be the premier employer. It's the company that everybody would most like to work for in today's world. So consequently, what they look for ought to be valuable information for everybody, and that's kind of what we're focusing on. But mostly what we're doing, excuse me for getting tongue-tied, mostly what we're doing is trying to get some insight into what the skills that they're looking for are really about, and where they come from and how you develop them. Because obviously the key to educational reform in America is finding ways to restructure education in such a way that we begin to focus on and address these particular skills. Yesterday I mentioned, and I didn't mention it again today, but I really think it is worth mentioning again, that the so-called Common Core skills, which are so prominent of late, seem to me at least to be headed in this direction. The reason that I support the Common Core skills more than anything else is because they seem to suggest a direction for education which is more liable to get us where we need to go than anything I've seen for a long time. And so I'm trying. I find it difficult, I admit, but I'm trying to find ways to put aside and not make too much out of the fact of who's paying for the Common Core skills to be adopted, or who's developing, or who was not at the table when they were developed, and all of these things that suggest conspiracies and everything else to a lot of people. What I'm looking at is the product itself, and saying if we can reform our education system in such a way that our teachers are working with their students, trying to bring education in directions which these skills call for, then we're on the right track. And that's kind of my point. We would love to hear from you on this issue especially, because I think it's one that all of us have very, very strong feelings about. Our phone number is area code 304-658-3333. That's 304-658-3333. If you would like to email me directly in matters related to education or other matters as well, by all means, feel free to do that. My email address is waobrien906@gmail.com. That's waobrien906@gmail.com. We were looking at a particular point in the article about finding a job at Google. And what we were looking at is the whole idea of general cognitive ability. This is the sentence we were looking at. For every job, Laszlo Bock says, for every job, the number one thing that we look for at Google is general cognitive ability. And it's not IQ. It's not a measure of how much you can learn. It's learning ability. It's the ability to process on the fly. It's the ability to pull together disparate bits of information. And this is the point that I was making last hour at the end when I inadvertently neglected to push the button and go back on the air. So consequently, I ended up making this point to myself. So maybe I better pick up with this particular point, because I think it's an important one. This idea of being able to pull together disparate pieces of information, what that means is taking pieces of information, facts, data, that on the surface don't seem to be connected, and finding ways that they do connect. What that effectively means is that you're taking pieces of information that have meaning, and by pulling them together, or the technical word is synthesizing them, you are creating new information, new knowledge. What that means to me, I mean, this is me talking, this is my own sense, but what I find exciting about this is that whenever any person, any one student or person does this, takes three or four pieces of information that on the surface don't even look like they're connected, and is able to come forth and saying, wait a minute, this is the way they do connect. This is how these things do connect. And then you make your point and show how these disparate pieces of information, or these isolated pieces of data, which don't seem related, are related. When you do that, you are creating new knowledge. You are creating something that, presumably, until we know different, nobody before has created. Have you ever thought of that? Real learning is creativity, is being created. There was an article, in fact, I'll try to find it. I have it in my files. There was an article in the Chronicle of Higher Education not too long ago, and the question that it addressed was, is it possible to teach creativity? And, of course, the first impression that one gets by looking at that title is, what would you put in a lecture which would teach people how to be creative? And the fact of the matter is that even possible? Can you take people who are not creative and make them creative just by saying, this is the way you create? There was a book that came out about 20 years ago on creativity. And the format was that it interviewed some of the brightest, most creative people in the world, Einstein and people like that from various fields. And the book consisted of a series of interviews with creative people. And the whole idea was that if you talk to enough creative people and you ask them the right questions, out of that is going to come a formula for creativity. In other words, what it is that all creative people have in common. And once we find that, why shouldn't we be able to teach it? The fact of the matter is, I believe the only way to teach creativity, if such a thing is even possible, is to create situations or circumstances which require people to be creative in order to find solutions. And if they're able to do it, then what they have done is create something that didn't exist before. They have taken three or four isolated pieces of information, each of which has meaning, and they have synthesized them in such a way that they have created new meaning. They have created something that didn't exist before. And it's that kind of creativity, that kind of ability to find ways that seemingly unrelated things relate, that Google identifies as cognitive ability. And if you think about it, Bach is right. That's not IQ. That's not a measure. You know, so-and-so has an IQ of 135. What does that mean? But general cognitive ability is the ability to learn, the ability to take pieces of information and find ways that they connect in order to create new or make new information, new meaning, new knowledge. And Google, according to Bach, Google has structured behavioral interviews that they give prospective candidates that will validate the fact that this candidate is predictive. In other words, they, in the process of their interviews, they have developed behavioral interview systems or processes that can validate creativity, the potential for creativity. That's the first of the five hiring attributes that Bach speaks to in this particular article. The second one, and now we're into new territory because we didn't get here yesterday. The second criterion is the plural. The second criterion is leadership. In particular, emergent leadership as opposed to traditional leadership. Most of us think leadership is leadership. And the assumption is if there's a group of people, the way you find the leader is, do you look out front? That's where the leader is. The guy in front is the leader. That's what most of us think. But what he's talking about is something called emergent leadership rather than traditional leadership. Traditional leadership is the stuff that everybody puts on their resumes. High school students get involved in all sorts of curricular activities in order to have stuff to build their resumes. College students are constantly building their resumes. How many times have you heard somebody say, well, you really ought to do this. You know, you really ought to take advantage of this and do this because it's going to look good on your resume. The whole name of the game is impressing other people with where you've been and what you know. That's traditional leadership. So Bach says that traditional leadership is, were you president of the chess club? Were you vice president of sales? How quickly did you get there? And Bach says, we don't care. What we care about is when faced with a problem and you're a member of a team, do you at the appropriate time step in and lead? Do you at the right time assume the role of leader? And of course the question is, when is the right time? How do you know that? And the implication is, the right time is when it becomes clear that you, more than anybody else on the team, are the person with the most to contribute to that particular problem, to that particular issue that the team is focused on. By listening to other people and what they say and what they contribute, excuse me, you begin to get a pretty good idea of where everybody's coming from on your team. And if there are areas that you know about that relate to this issue that the others aren't expressing, then it's time for you to step up and express them. What Google is looking for is that people who are willing to do that at the appropriate time step up and lead. But there's more. Just as critical, Bach says, are you willing to step back and stop leading when it's appropriate, when the appropriate time comes to do that? Are you willing to step back at the appropriate time and let somebody else lead? Because Bach says what's critical, what's crucial here to be an effective leader in this environment is that you have to be willing to relinquish power as well as willing to seize it. It's a special kind of person that can do this. It's a very sensitive, very insightful, very perceptive person who begins to size up the situation and is able to know when the situation calls for me to step forward or to step back. It has nothing to do with my ego. It has nothing to do with my efforts to make myself look good. It has everything to do with finding answers to the issue at hand, solving the problem. Achieving the goal that the team was created to achieve. That's the objective. Not me in making myself look good, not making anybody else on the team look bad, not helping somebody we particularly like on the team to look good. The real issue is getting the job done, getting the tasks done. And what Google is looking for are people who are able to size up the situation and are willing to take for themselves the proper role at the proper time. Bach says, what else? Humility and ownership. And this is a quote. It's feeling the sense of responsibility, the sense of ownership, to step in, he said, and try to solve any problem. And the humility to step back and embrace the better ideas of others. Your end goal, explained Bach, is what can we do together to problem solve? I've contributed my piece, then I step back. It's not just humility in creating space for others to contribute, says Bach. It's intellectual humility. Without humility, you are unable to learn. And this next issue, hear well, because I'm sure you can assign names to this particular characteristic. Without humility, you are unable to learn. It is why research shows that many graduates from hotshot business schools plateau. They reach a certain point, and that's it. Successful, bright people rarely experience failure, and so they don't learn how to learn from failure, said Bach. Think about this. We hear this all our lives, but it doesn't really mean anything until now. You can't learn unless you fail. If you've never failed, then you can't learn. And so basically what these folks are looking for in a prospective employee is people who are willing to take gambles or risks and willing to fail. Most of us have heard this all our lives about picking yourself up and dusting yourself off and getting back into the fray and all these other tales that we grow up hearing, the Horatio Alger rags to riches stuff. But the reality is that we learn so much from failure. And what Google is saying is we're very suspicious of people that have never put themselves in a position where they've ever experienced failure, because we have no evidence to show how they will handle failure and whether they will learn from it or whether they will let failure defeat them. And so the fact that you've failed and failed again and failed again is not necessarily a negative. To Google, it's a very, very part of the a very important part of the positive. Without going off into anything too detailed here, I would suggest to you that a major characteristic of our education system is the idea that we better not fail. We can't fail. The way we indicate failure is with grades. We give F's. But talk to any student, I don't care at what level, and they'll tell you, if you have F's on your transcript, you're dead. Consequently, my number one objective better be to make sure that I don't have anything on my transcript that suggests failure, that I failed at anything. I want a 4.0 grade point average. I want my transcript to show that I did all of these things. I was involved in all this community volunteer stuff. I was president of this and vice president of that and treasurer of this and all of that. And what Google would say is your transcript is a fabulous record of what you've done. But it doesn't tell us anything about you, what you are liable to be able to do next, or what you are most likely to do next, because you never had to experience that. We can promise you that if you're hired here, you're going to be confronted with issues greater and more challenging than you've ever experienced before. How will you react to that? There's nothing in your record that gives us a clue, because you have spent your life padding your record. You've taken all the gut classes. You've dropped all the difficult classes. from a look of your transcript, it indicates that every time the going gets tough, you quit. What's the message that we're supposed to take from that? Here's what Bach says. Successful, bright people rarely experience failure, so they don't learn how to learn from that failure. Instead, they commit the fundamental attribution error, which is, if something good happens, it's because I'm a genius. If something bad happens, it's because someone's an idiot, or I didn't get the right resources, or the market moved on me, or something. What we've seen, he says, is that people who are the most successful here at Google, the people who we want to hire, will have a fierce position. They'll argue like hell. They'll be zealots about their point of view. But then you say, here's a new fact, a new piece of information. And the people we want to hire will say, oh, that changes everything. You're right. What we want our people to have is a big ego and a small ego in the same person at the same time. Think about that. A big ego and a small ego in the same person at the same time. Whenever I think about the people that say, if things work out, it's because I'm a genius. If people don't work out, it's because of some other idiot or some other excuse. In other words, failure is always somebody's fault, never mine. Success is always my fault. It's always my doing. Apparently, what Bach is saying is that Google, that's a red flag that they look for. And finally, Bach says, the least important attribute they look for is expertise. Knowledge of subject. If you take somebody who has high cognitive ability, is innately curious, willing to learn, and has emergent leadership skills, and you hire them as an HR person or a finance person, and they have absolutely no content knowledge at all, and you compare them to someone who's been doing just that one thing and is a world expert, the expert will go, I've seen this 100 times before. Here's what you have to do. What we've found, Bach says, is that most of the time, the non-expert will come up with the same answer as the expert. Because most of the time, it's not that hard. Sure, once in a while, they'll mess it up. But once in a while, they'll come up with an answer that's totally new. And there's huge value in that. So again, the person who is trained to be an expert in one particular area that knows the whole ball of wax better than anybody else. What they know is what's supposed to happen. And if something out of the ordinary comes up that's not supposed to be there, chances are these people are going to be thrown off path. They're going to be flummoxed. They're going to be confused. They're going to be challenged. They're going to be rendered impotent. But on the other hand, the person who has cognitive ability, who's curious, who's willing to learn, even if they don't have the experience, they'll end up coming up with the same answer because they know how to solve problems. They know how to collect evidence. They know how to size up situations. And chances are, the abilities they have to solve problems are going to make up for the lack of expertise they have in that particular area. And more often than not, they're going to come up with the same answers as the expert does. The only difference is, if they make a mistake, it's just as likely next time that they're going to have a booming success. If the expert makes a mistake, there's no recovery. Here's Bach's conclusion. To sum up, Bach's approach to hiring, this is Tom Friedman speaking, talent can come in so many different forms and be built in so many non-traditional ways today. Hiring offices have to be alive to everyone. Besides brand name colleges. Because when you look at people who don't go to school and make their way in the world, those are exceptional human beings. And we should do everything we can to find those people, Bach said. Let me repeat that again. Talent can come in so many different forms, and it can be built in so many non-traditional ways that hiring offices have to be alive to everyone besides brand name colleges. The mere fact that somebody comes to you from Stanford, that in itself is not enough. When you look at somebody who didn't go to school and yet is making their way in the world, you're looking at an exceptional human being. Google needs to do everything it can to find these people. Too many colleges, he added, don't deliver on what they promise. You generate a ton of debt. You don't learn the most useful things for your life. It's just an extended adolescence. It seems to me that what Bach is saying here is a major condemnation of what many of our colleges and universities are doing or not doing. It's not that they can't do these things, it's that they don't do these things. And instead, they put their priorities in totally different areas. And so consequently, they're causing students to focus on the wrong things and to look in the wrong directions and put their priorities on the wrong areas. If you look at life as a horse race, colleges are basically programming too many people to put their money on the wrong horse. At least that's what I think Bach is saying to me. Google attracts so much talent, it can afford to look beyond traditional metrics like GPA. For most young people, though, going to college and doing well is still the best way to master the tools needed for many careers. But Bach is saying something important to them, too. Beware. Your degree is not a proxy for your ability to do any job. The world only cares about and pays off on what you can do with what you know, and it doesn't care how you learned it. And in an age when innovation is increasingly a group endeavor, it also cares about a lot of soft skills, leadership, humility, collaboration, adaptability, loving to learn and relearn. This will be true no matter where you go to work. The issue, I know I've said this before here at the Virtual Center, and I want to reiterate it because it's in this article as well. What's paying off in today's world is not what you know or what you did. It's what you have learned from what you know and what you've done that becomes a pretty dependable predictor of where you'll go and where you'll be in the future. How much of the kind of person you are can we deduce from where you've gone and what you've done, and what, more important, what you've learned from where you've gone and what you've done. Because success is increasingly not based on what you know, but more on what you can do as a result of what you know. How many times have we said this? That's the article. I can't let this opportunity pass without asking all of us to reflect for a time on how these criteria, these priorities, square or don't square with the educational system that we know. There are so many things that jump out of this particular piece that to me speak loud and clear about some of the things that we don't know and don't do properly in our education system. The one that I'm thinking of right now, which I can't resist beginning with. If I'm the instructor and you're the student, and if there's something I want you to know, I want you to learn, the worst way for me to guarantee that you'll learn it is for me to tell it to you, is for me to communicate the answers to you. Because if I give you the answer, you don't do anything. The only option you've got is to memorize that answer. You didn't find it. You didn't devise the strategy for finding it. You didn't do the legwork to find it. You didn't go to the library and look it up. You didn't go to the internet and look it up. And the more complex the issue is that you're trying to learn, the more important not going through those primary steps, the more important are the learning experiences that you've never had. Whatever learning experiences were involved in reaching this particular right answer, I'm the one that had them as teacher, not you as student. So consequently, I may have learned a lot. And so what I'm doing is defining teaching as sharing with you what I learned. There's no way that you can benefit from what I learned. The only thing you can benefit from is what you learn. And the only way you can learn is if you are presented with the opportunity to learn. And that means that the problem that demands an answer has to be your problem, not my problem. You're the one that has to solve it. You're the one that has to decide who you need to bring into the picture in order to help you solve it. What skills do you need to solve this problem, depending on how complex it is? Who do you know that has those particular skills? And getting everybody together, building a team, defining the problem, and then each person taking their particular strength, academic strength, and applying it to the solution of the aspect of the problem that is most appropriate to that skill. That's what has to happen. We continue to focus on education as an individual experience. we continue to grade students independently. We continue to assume that learning and everything that goes with it is an individual thing. One of the things that comes through loud and clear in this particular document from Google is that the kind of problems that Google needs to solve are not problems that any one person can solve. There's no one person that has the answers. The answers require creativity. And chances are, depending on how complex they are, that creativity has to come from a lot of different sources. Teams solve problems. Individuals receive an education. We've got to change that. We have got to find ways to instill the idea that problem solving means finding new meaning, taking existing things that we know and finding ways to synthesize them in such a way that we discover something we didn't know. We've created new meaning. That's the process. That's the educational process. The irony is, it's not that it's, if you think about it, it's not really that difficult. And what I mean is, it's kind of easy to understand. The real challenge is, how do you integrate this into our current educational system? How do you find ways to change the operative assumptions that have driven our education system for so long? As part of the copy for the website that I've been talking about for the Virtual Center, I'm writing material related to education in the Republic as addressed by a couple of the major founders, specifically Thomas Jefferson and Benjamin Rush, both of whom spent an inordinate amount of time focusing on education as a key ingredient in making the Republic that we created, that we received as a result of independence, making it work. And one of the things that is very clear is that both Jefferson and Benjamin Rush believed that only the few were capable of handling real education. That the vast majority of citizens were incapable of contributing anything meaningful to the enterprise. In order to preserve the order and stability of the Republic, what was most critical is that those who would be followers are taught what it means to be a follower. It's one of the most difficult issues that I've ever confronted because it contradicts, it violates everything that we want to believe, not only about education, but about our nation, about the founders of our nation. I don't for a second mean to imply that these people are elite, arrogant, insensitive, aristocratic, unfeeling people who believe that they're better than other people. What I believe is that these people are operating from what they think they know. They are pulling together and trying to apply the very best of what they know about government and what they know about people. And their basic assumption is, if you look through history and you look around this, around you, it's very obvious that some people are able to make meaningful contributions to the quality of life for everybody. But the vast majority of people can't. And in order to govern, what you've got to do is find a way that these two groups of people can coexist and get along and live together. And what you have to do is build in a sense of respect. The founders, the 18th century, called it deference. People need to be taught to defer to the wisdom of their betters. Ironically, that's not that different from what Bach is saying in this article about Google. He calls it leadership. You have got to know when to step back and let somebody else take over. What that means is you've got to understand the issues well enough to know that you, meaning the group, has reached the point where you personally don't have anything else to contribute to the solution. And if there's going to be a solution, it's going to come from somebody else, not you. Somehow, we've got to be able to recognize that and make it work. And do it in a way which doesn't demean anybody. The founders believed that the only way to do it was to implant within citizens the idea of deference. The idea that certain people are much more capable of solving problems and coming up with solutions than other people. Basically, let's be basic, let's be honest. Some people are a lot more creative than other people. And they, what they believed is that what we need to do is we need to be able to make sure that the right people are in the right positions in order to get problems solved, in order for progress to be made. But in order to preserve the stability and order of the republic, we need also to make sure that the vast majority of people respect and are willing to go along with and accept the right of the qualified to make the decisions for which they are qualified. That means we've got to basically implant in a sense of deference. We need to emphasize the idea that people need to defer to their betters. And on the assumption that in this republic, people are free, Jefferson said in the Declaration, all men are created equal. And they are endowed by the Creator with certain unalienable rights. And among these are the rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of property. In a society where everybody is free and everybody is able to pursue success, then one must conclude that those who are most successful in experiencing success are successful because they are the most capable. Consequently, a measure of success, property, the amount of wealth, visible wealth, that you control becomes the most dependable signal or sign of your ability. Consequently, deference tends to be connected with respecting wealth, respecting the abilities of the wealthy. If they have more than you do, it's because they have more ability than you do. And when it comes time to make decisions, you want the people with the most ability to be the one to make them. So what you've got to do is make sure that people not only understand that, but are committed to it, and so well know it that they never question it. And if we are successful in creating that, in achieving that, then we will have a stable society, because the right people will call the shots and the rest of the people will willingly accept their right to do so. Gordon Wood, in his studies of the 18th century of the American Revolution and the period immediately after it, Gordon Wood comes back over and over again to the idea of deference. And he traces it philosophically back into the medieval period in Europe, to the Middle Ages, and to the basic idea of what constitutes what, for lack of a better term, people call a monarchical society. A society which is comprised of different people with different levels of ability, both of wealth, power, and ability. And the idea that the order and the stability of any society is predicated on the respect that people have for their betters. And so consequently, the founders believed that you had to build that kind of deferential personality trait into every person. Everybody, no matter where they were or what their level was or how successful they were, everybody had to know that everybody is not equally capable. And people needed to recognize that there are some people that are more capable than you are. And you constantly need to be reminded that you must willingly defer to their talents and their special abilities. I don't think I've ever mentioned this before on the Virtual Center, but I think this is an appropriate place to focus on this a little bit. We've got not that much time left. We've got about seven or eight minutes left in our program before Bob Kincaid takes off on his program on the Head On Radio Network at 6 p.m. But it seems to me we're at the point right now where I think it's important to mention that one of the things that you see, if you really spend time reading colonial literature and 18th century American revolution, during the revolution, the newspapers and the poems and the stories that appear in the newspapers. And one of the things you see over and over again in colony after colony is mention of the fifth commandment, honor thy father and thy mother. And what what you begin to appreciate, you can see this specifically because I've done this. If you look at some of the Puritan sermons in Massachusetts, the number of sermons that take off from the premise of the Fifth Commandment are unbelievable. It becomes very clear in reading the sources that the Fifth Commandment is a very, very important part of the entire social and political structure that exists in early America. And what you find from the ministers, from the preachers, is often something like a quotation of the Fifth Commandment, honor thy father and mother, followed by questions. What is meant by father and mother? And traditionally the answer is, what is meant by father and mother means anybody that's in a position superior to you. Because the basic premise of the Fifth Amendment and God's mandate to honor thy father and mother is to recognize that in God's world, people are born to fill specific and different roles. And the assumption is that God's plan is not for a society where everybody is equal in terms of outcome. Rather, in terms of outcome, everybody is unequal. There are rich and there are poor. There are intelligent and there are not so intelligent. There are the physically strong and the physically weak. There are men and women, husbands and wives, parents and children, managers and employees, preachers and congregation, teachers and students. In every one of those examples, we are confronted with the realities of a diverse, differentiated society in which certain people are in positions of authority over others and at the same time find themselves in positions where they are expected to defer to others above them. And because of the religious connotations within which the Fifth Commandment falls, then the logical assumption is that God, in His infinite wisdom, created a society where people had different roles to fill. And the key challenge of God's children is to fashion a society in which God's plan for the ideal community is fulfilled. Consequently, teaching deference does not just have political and social connotations, it has real religious connotations and roots. Religious people who read and abide by scriptures recognize that God's plan is not for a society where everybody is the same, but a society in which everybody is different, except in relationship to God Himself. We are all children of God. In the face of God, we are all equal. But within society, the way society evaluates talent and ability and all the rest of it, some of us are much more qualified and much more capable than others. So the point is that in the sources, the Fifth Commandment frequently becomes a key ingredient as justification for building deference, a sense of deference into society. And Gordon Wood and many of the other people who have studied 18th century society make the point that you really can't understand the nature of society in the 18th century unless you understand this principle of deference. I would suggest to you that much of what we've seen today in terms of this How You Get a Job at Google article, in terms of the skills and the qualities, is that what Google is looking for is a product, a potential hiree, a prospective employee, which is different from, rather than consistent with, the standard idea of a deferential society. What Bach talks about is a willingness to defer to your betters, yes, in particular issues, but at the same time to recognize that in other issues, you're going to be the one who is the expert. And the key ingredient is to recognize that everybody has something positive and creative to bring to the table. And it's the sum total, the ability to bring all of these different levels of expertise together that makes for the successful solving of problems. I would suggest to you, however, that there's a basic inconsistency, a basic contradiction between the way we as a society educate our young people and the realities of what Google's looking for in its employees. Because we tend to build our education system, even today, on the same kinds of assumptions that have driven it for 200 and some odd years. And that is a recognition that deference is important. But increasingly, we have allowed ourselves to become a society where the major measure of that importance is financial, is property ownership, is the way that our society defines success. Just the other day, a friend was making me aware of a particular point, a particular piece of information that he had seen in surfing the internet. And it's this. In the United States of America, in 47 of the 50 states, the highest paid public employee in that state is either a football coach or a basketball coach. As we sign off at 59 after the hour, please think about that. Thank you for listening. Thank you for joining us at the Virtual Center. We invite you to come back tomorrow. Enjoy your evening. Be safe, and thank you.
Bob Kincaid, 3 hours of conversation cussing and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Day of February 2014. It's Titanic Tuesday on the Horn. Head On RadioNetwork.com is our home. That's where you'll find entree into the chat room, which I encourage you to jump into. Folks will be wandering by
As the program gets a little deeper into the, program. You'll also find our brand new shiny Listen Live button, which you can use to listen there at your desktop. Of course, if you're on a mobile device of some sort, we highly recommend the apps from Stitcher and TuneIn. They are both quite handy and quite good. The pay version, I think, is a little bit better than the so-called light version. And please remember that any ads that you may hear for any disgusting oil company or anything like that on TuneIn come from us, and we are not being compensated by any oil companies. No, 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 we are not. So, you know, alternatives. It's all about the alternatives. Also, of course, do check back by periodically at headonradionetwork.com because we're posting news stories there every day that we think you will be of some interest to you and to the Horn family at large. You will also find there the PayPal button. That is how we keep all of this going, how we keep this little effort on the air and have managed to do so all told for 10 years now. And most of that 10 years has been because of you. So thank you very, very kindly. This evening we begin. Got a kind note from our buddy Tom in California who got us started this evening with a kind contribution. So instead of beginning the evening, you know, we had a $100 shortfall last night. And so as a result, we were going to start with a $250 goal this evening. It's been now knocked down to $125. And I've got good news. Because we also have Sparky, our longtime chat room moderator and moderator extraordinaire of the Horn Molloy Skype chat group. Sparky has put on the table this evening his pull the pin challenge. And that means that there's $100 on the table as long as there are people who are willing to match $100, which would go all the way to just short of $25. From getting us up to speed with fundraising as we limp out of the month of February. And it's not that the limping isn't so much a financial thing as it is spiritual, emotional, existential thing. Oh, goodbye, February. Go away, go away. You know, usually, at least here in Appalachia, we get a couple of little gentle hints that winter will end and that we will someday feel warmth on our faces again. That has apparently been delayed. We are experiencing plummeting temperatures. We've got a low tonight of 23, which is tolerable. Then tomorrow night's low is 16 and the low Thursday night is 9. Ugh. Which means, you know, hey, Pa, put another bottle of propane on the right. So that's where we are. So as long as there are members of the Horn family who want to kick in $100, Sparky is willing to match that with his own $100 pull the pin challenge. And gosh, I hope that happens. I really, really do. There are bills constantly in need of paying around here, and that's, as noted, how we keep all of this going. Let's see. It is Titanic Tuesday, which means we try to focus on moments of profound brilliance. That's said sarcastically amongst the right wing. And what more so than this story? Isaac and a number of you have pointed this out to me. Wow. Talk about Titanic intellect. In this country, our gun-mad culture is obsessed with proving that, you know, there ain't nothing wrong with having a gun. It's patriotic. We's barming bears and bear arms, right? Because one of these days, them jackbooted, blue-helmeted thugs of that Kenyan Muslim
anti-colonialist, deep-seated hatred of white people. Obama's going to send people through the doors just to get our guns and maybe send us off to one of them Obama or FEMA re-education camps. And we ain't going to stand for it because we're Americans. Right? And guns don't kill people. People kill people. Right?
Dateline somewhere in Michigan. Oakland County, Michigan, as a matter of fact. Not too awfully far from Detroit. That's Oakland County that has the county administrator or whatever he is who advised people never to stop for gasoline in Detroit. I mean, you're just begging to be raped or murdered or robbed or... Right, the racist bastard. Can't remember what the guy's name is right now. Well, our first example of Titanic intellect comes from Oakland County, Michigan, where a Bubba, and remember, one need not be a resident of south of the Mason-Dixie line in order to be a Bubba, where a Bubba took his guns after having a few, apparently. And he was doing some, what he was doing, this whole thing developed because he was doing some mansplaining for his girlfriend. Yeah. He had made it 36 years on this planet, and in year 36, the stupid caught up with him. The Second Amendment-driven stupid. Because, of course, the Second Amendment guarantees the right to bear arms as long as you are a member of a well-regulated militia, but the Supreme Court of the United States said all that well-regulated militia stuff was just so much boilerplate. Sure it is. Well, there it was, in Independence Township, Oakland County, Michigan, happened this past Sunday night, in which a woman and her boyfriend were sitting, I guess, discussing the merits of firearms, at which point our genius in question declared, "All guns are safe as long as they're unloaded." And to prove his point, got out three handguns. He took handgun number one, placed it to his head, and pulled the trigger. Click. See? As long as they're unloaded, they're completely safe. Took handgun number two, placed the barrel, the muzzle against his head, pulled the trigger, and click. Perfectly safe. As long as you maintain your guns in good order, and you make sure that you know which one's loaded and which one's not, they're all perfectly safe. I mean, it's no different than a hammer or a screwdriver. They're just tools. Picks up handgun number three, places it against the muzzle against the side of his head, and bang! And dead. For some reason or another, the Oakland County Medical Examiner feels the need to perform an autopsy. I don't know if they're looking, well, for some portion of his brain left that's just labeled stupid. Oh, Bob, come on. Can't you have some sympathy? I mean, there's a lot of people are sad out of this. Yeah, I know a little bit about that. I know how sad it can make you. I know how you can be 51 years old and still have dreams of the 16-year-old brother who never saw year 17 because someone assumed a handgun was unloaded, pointed it at the side of his head, and pulled the trigger. Only it wasn't unloaded. Yeah, it's horrifying. But Jesus, really? This is the ultimate outcome of the paranoid fantasies of the gun crazy right. Whatever it is that drove that conversation, that drove this fella who'd had apparently had a few. I mean, what is it? If you're going to do that, does it somehow reduce one's machismo if you check to make sure there really isn't a round in the chamber before you do it? Because you just have to prove that, you know, I always make sure I know which gun's unloaded and which one's loaded. Yeah. For that matter, if you're absolutely hell-bent on doing this, why not go out in the front yard or out in the backyard? Or maybe down to the range. Or for that matter, why point it at your head? Why not point it at the ground? I mean, if something should go, oh, why do we bother? The news report from CBS Detroit says merely, as noted, the girlfriend said the victim had been drinking most of the day, and sheriff's officials said alcohol appears to have been a factor in the shooting. Sounds like a story from Alabama, but no, it's Michigan, which has given up on the notion of good government. Witness their governor and the loss of workers' rights in that state. They're trying to be Alabama. And this guy just took them one step closer. There were, by the way, 3 children in the home. They were not his biological children. But I think when one gets down to the point of talking about gunplay inside a home, the biological relationship between the person handling the guns, the drunk person handling the guns, and the children themselves becomes rather irrelevant. Email coming in from Jim, who says, Russian roulette, hell, I'll take blackjack or beach blanket bingo. This guy's nuts. Well, but I confess I never studied the rules of Russian roulette. And isn't Russian roulette kind of, and this isn't directed to Jim, this is a larger inquiry, isn't Russian roulette kind of a slur? Sort of like the way some people talk about Mexican firing squads, or is it a practice that began in Russia? I honestly don't know. It just always seemed kind of unfair. Why don't we call it really stupid handgun roulette? Yeah. Don't know. But we have apparently reached a place in this country where, as Jack in Shreveport notes, even basic assumptions that the good gun handling bubbas were always taught, i.e., a responsible gun owner has always been taught, as far as I know, that the rule is that one should always assume a gun is loaded. Even that has gone by the board in this frenzy of paranoid, manic fear that somehow that one in their White House is going to come and get their guns and freedom's going to die and the flag is falling and... No, around... There are 2 rules. One is to assume that any firearm is loaded, and until proven, conclusively proven otherwise, and one does not prove that by sticking the muzzle against one's head and pulling the trigger. And here, and there's a corollary in the broadcast world that one always assumes a microphone is live. That's especially applicable when one is broadcasting out on the government-censored terrestrial airwaves, where merely saying booger can cost you $475,000. It's costly, just the same as assuming a firearm is unloaded can be even more costly. You guys, now I'm getting cues from the Horn family. This from Marty. Marty writes, Bob, you forgot to echo Wolverines! Yeah. You know what? I was tickled pink the other day. I saw a Wolverines reference on Charlie Pierce's Esquire politics blog, and I was like, wow, hey, Charlie. Jesus. But that's, you know, it's okay. It's okay. Oh, but America is completely on board with having drunk people play with firearms and kill themselves in front of someone that they presumptively care a lot about. And yeah, this arises out of mansplaining, and mansplaining, oh dear God. No, honey, what you just don't understand about the nature of protecting freedom in America. You always got to know about whether your guns is loaded or... This is a house where he lived with her, in which there were three children, and he apparently didn't know one of the guns was loaded. What, is this one of those try to find the silver lining things, and we're just happy that we're not reported talking about a situation in which a 12-year-old shot his or her 7-year-old sibling? Asked for comment, the 36-year-old live-in boyfriend said, well, I was sure they were all unloaded. Sure, were you? Sure. Yeah. Yeah, I'm with Jim. I'd much prefer blackjack or beach blanket bingo or spin the bottle or who knows. And thanks very much to Asa and to Jeremy for getting us started this evening. We are now only $75 away from meeting Sparky's Pull the Pin Challenge, and that is most helpful. Thank you. Thank you very much, both of you. Where do you go after a story like that? More stupid? Because there is more stupid. How about a K Street lobbyist? Well, I don't know if he's actually on K Street, but a Washington, D.C. lobbyist named Jack Berkman. Now, this guy has been, among other things, counsel to a member of Congress, Rick Lazio, a right-wing Republican from New York. He currently represents lobbies for companies that manufacture medical devices and clean energy, really? And some pharmaceutical companies. Yeah. Well, Jack Berkman has decided to chime in on the issue of Michael Sams. Who, as we all know, came out a little while back and is being evaluated, one would presume, even as we speak at the, or maybe not even as we speak, but at the NFL combines. And Jack Berkman is really, really upset about the fact that there might be a homosexual in the No Fun League. I mean, the National Football League. I mean, really upset. He has gone so far as to draft and tender what he hopes will be a bill to ban gay people from playing football in the NFL. Yeah. In the statement that he issued on Monday, he said, "We are losing our decency as a nation. Imagine your son being forced to shower with a gay man. That's a horrifying prospect for every mom in the country. What in the world has this nation come to?" He went on and said, "If the NFL has no morals and no values, then Congress must find values for it." Oh, really? The NFL that buried its own head injury problem. The NFL that has players who are who find themselves in trouble in strip joints and involved at least tangentially in murder. All of that, Jack Berkman remains silent. Michael Sams comes out as gay, and suddenly the NFL has no morals and no values. Right. And then, as Marty notes, the idea of the Congress of the United States finding morals for anybody is so laughable as to be rendered just silly. Now, apparently, Jack Berkman is a shameless self-promoter. Because after doing all of this, he admitted that it was a publicity stunt. And this publicity stunt of his, he says, has already garnered the interest, this according to an article in Slate, has already garnered the interest of at least 5 right-wing Republicans. And at least 1 conservative senator. One can only guess who the conservative senator might be. Ted Cruz? Mike Lee? Jefferson Beauregard Sessions III? One simply doesn't know. On the other hand, people are not taking the publicity stunt any too well. Daniel Pencina, a principal at the Raven Group, according to Think Progress, and president of Q Street, an association of LGBT lobbyists and advocates, told Think Progress, Berkman's clients should not only be concerned with being associated with his views, but also his judgment and competence as an advocate. Ultimately, he's promoting his public image at the expense of his clients. That raises real questions about whether he can adequately represent his clients' interests before policymakers. Of course, I am a silver lining kind of guy.
And I can't help but think, Jack Bergman, yeah. Oh, you're here to talk to me today about the needs of your giant pharmaceutical client? Yeah, okay, why don't you get out? I mean, it could work out as a positive. But then again, what's this about him being a lobbyist for clean energy? Hey, maybe this is all just a tiger trap. Maybe by putting this out there and getting a whole bunch of right-wing weirdos to jump on board behind it, you know, say your Louis Gohmert. I mean, there's five members of Congress already interested in a congressionally mandated, ban on gay men in the NFL. Can we just, of course, you know, Steve King. Louis Gohmert, maybe? I mean, come on, make the calls. These right-wing Republicans, you know, we need to get government off of people's backs, unless, of course, government's muddling around in women's reproductive organs, or maybe peeping underneath over the transom to find out what's going on in bedrooms and see if anybody's having sex the wrong way. Yeah. Note coming in from Jeremy in Vermont. Rubber and Velcro. A little better with vodka. Yeah, can't have any of that gay in the NFL. Even though it's quite obvious there have been gay NFL players before. It's just a matter of having someone say so while playing. But apparently, this country has an almost limitless ability to tolerate hate and bigotry. Greenbacker Renewable Energy is one of his clients, and David Scherr of that company said, "I personally do not agree with his positions, nor are they the positions of Greenbacker." Ed St. Armour of GPROP, an international business company, whatever that means, said, "I think those positions are a little bizarre. It certainly wouldn't be anything the company would participate in. They're not our values at all." And then there's Bruce Brimacombe, who is the founder and CEO of GOE3 and Jeslin Media. He said, "I believe in doing things that will bring this country together, not pull it apart." GOE3 is an electric car company, by the way. He said apparently GOE3 hasn't been getting just a hell of a lot of Berkman's attentions. And he said, "We're not high on his priority list. I think he'd spend his time doing that." But see, there's a lot of money, and I do mean a lot of money, in hate. Oodles of money. Tons of money in hate. And frankly, you know, somebody like Jack Bergman doesn't give a good goddamn where he's getting the money, as long as he is getting the money. And the hate-filled, bigoted freaks of the right wing, well, they'll pay to have their positions put out there. They really will. Now, granted, this is not
this is not Prayer Meeting Wednesday, but where this is concerned, it's really, this is a genius situation. So we're not going to limit ourselves to Wednesday just because it happens to be a religious tint or flavor or whatnot. No. Consequently, it is, I bet you know who we're going to be talking about, don't you? Sure, why not? This is easy, right? I mean, everybody from the NFL who is urging the governor of Arizona to move carefully before doing something as stupid as signing this what do we call this Jim Gay Crow law into bill into law in Arizona. Well, just remember, the other side has a lot of money and a lot of crazy, and it's the money, not necessarily. And you know, Berkman will tolerate the crazy in the name of getting the money. I mean, there's a long history of right-wing people doing that. Think Jack Abramoff, and I didn't even know you could do that to Abram. Enter. Don't chew all the way through the tennis ball and the straps yet, Jeremy. Enter Brian Fisher. Stanford graduate. Aren't you proud?
You might have heard the Girl Scouts are in trouble. There's a boycott that's been called on the sale of Girl Scout cookies because of their affiliation with Planned Parenthood. The Girl Scouts have turned into a pro-Planned Parenthood, pro-abortion organization for girls. I mean, I would think most right-thinking moms and dads wouldn't want to have their girls have anything to do with an organization like Girl Scouts that's working arm-in-arm, linked with Planned Parenthood, to promote an abortion mentality among young girls. Anyway, they're selling their Girl Scout cookies right now, and one girl in San Francisco, she knows what marijuana does to people's appetite. She set up right outside a pot dispensary in the city in San Francisco, sold 117 boxes of Girl Scout cookies in 2 hours. Now, apparently down in Colorado, the Girl Scouts there have directed their girls to stay away from the pot shops. Now,
time out. Jack, time out, okay? What happened to the right-wing adoration of the entrepreneurial free market spirit? Isn't that pretty smart? Setting up your Girl Scout cookie stand outside a place that might tend to be visited by people who either then or later will have an overwhelming case of the munchies, what Stanford graduate Brian Fisher points out as what marijuana does to the appetite. Do you know anything about that, Brian? Out of all that time you spent out there, Palo Alto, Bay Area, anything? Bueller? No? No, he was busy on his knees, praying the entire time he was out there getting it. Then again, maybe it's like the Stanford back of the matchbook correspondence school of, I don't know, Stanford, Mississippi. Is there a Stanford, Mississippi? There's a Samford University in Birmingham that I think is run by the Baptists. Maybe it's a misprint. But Orton praise a person for being so. I mean, if the Girl Scouts sold lemonade, wouldn't it be smart if a Girl Scout set one up on outside a health and fitness center where people had just gone running and exercising and athleticing and everything? Wouldn't that be smart? Oh, for heaven's sakes! But do go on. Go on, proud son of Palo Alto.
I want to talk just for a moment about what's going on in Arizona. The governor of Arizona, Jan Brewer, has a bill on her desk right now. It's passed both houses of the Arizona legislature. This is a bill that would protect religious liberty in Arizona for Christian businessmen, Christian business owners. We've been over this story.
Okay, I just want to check, because this is a religious liberty bill, or so they say. Does it not protect the rights of Hindu business owners to reject gay people? How about Jewish business owners? Can they reject gay people and refuse services to gay people? How about Muslim business owners? Under this religious liberty bill, do they get to reject refuse services to gay people? Because Brian here just said, Brian,
what have you been up to?
He says it only protects Christian business owners. Are Christians the only people who are filled with miserable, abject hatred for people who have sex the way that the Christians decide they shouldn't have it? I mean, are all the other world religions just down with being gay now, and the poor little hate-filled, homophobic, bigoted, prejudiced Christians are the only ones that are out there on the outside looking in, shivering in the cold? I mean, religious liberty is religious liberty. It's not Christian religious liberty. Check me, but I don't think the word Christian or Christianity or Christ or Jesus or any of that appears in the First Amendment. Do they? No, I didn't think so. But do, please. Back to the guy from Stanford.
The Girl Scouts there have directed their girls to stay away from the pot shops. Now, I want to talk just for a moment about what's going on in Arizona. The governor of Arizona, Jan Brewer, has a bill on her desk right now. It's passed both houses of the Arizona legislature. This is a bill that would protect religious liberty in Arizona for Christian businessmen, Christian business owners. We've been over the stories about the baker in Oregon that could wind up going to jail because he wouldn't bake a cake to participate in a same-sex wedding ceremony, even though same-sex marriage is illegal in Oregon. We got a florist in Washington that's being sued by the attorney general. We've got the photographer in New Mexico that's fined $6,700 because she wouldn't participate in a same-sex ceremony, even though at the time same-sex relationships had no legal status of any kind in New Mexico. So Arizona legislature has put a bill on the desk of Governor Jan Brewer to sign this bill that would protect business owners in Arizona from being penalized by the state for running their businesses according to Christian conviction.
Me, I'd like to see a few more Christian convictions. Oh, never mind. Do you notice how we have our fun at Brian's expense? I can't tell if that's hair or a helmet on his head. But I mean, he looks like a sort of sagging at the jowls Race Bannon from Johnny Quest when you get right down to it. But you know, we have our fun at his expense, but he is kind of a slick one. Did you notice how he said that same-sex relationships in New Mexico have no status whatsoever? Now, this is the same guy who says that all rights come from God. Mm-hmm. And he bemoans big government. And he wants government off our backs and into our bedrooms. Never mind. And yet, at the same time, apparently, he thinks that you can't be gay unless the government has somehow passed an It's Okay to Be Gay bill. Never mind the fact that laws against so-called sodomy, as it applies to either Christians or heterosexuals or homosexuals, or Christians for that matter. I don't even want to think about Christians having sex. Scary.
Well, we've had sex two times, and we have two children. But in just, you know, one little moment of babbling, he has declared that gay people simply don't exist because that big government has not declared that it's okay for them to have sex. Now, this guy is crazier than a sprayed roach. And if you had the money to put a pretty good private detective on him, I'm pretty sure you'd come up with some fairly interesting stuff. But, Jeremy pointing out, Bob, Gollum from Lord of the Rings is a nicer and better looking and acting person than Brian could dream of being. It's a pity Ferg's not back here. He does a killer Gollum. But I just wanted to point out the way that they characterize these things. And you notice it's not when he talks about the gay crow or Jim Gay bill in Arizona, it's not about people refusing service. It's about the government not being able to punish people for refusing service. So he just leaps right over that whole all men are created equal business from the Declaration of Independence. When ordinarily, like, they like to thump on that the same way they thump on their Bibles. Really. Do proceed. Because this is just full of Lulus. Go on, Brian.
And so we are hoping that Jan Brewer will sign this thing, both of the senators, John McCain, Jeff Flake. They're out there telling her not to sign it. You get a lot of pressure from Big Gay not to...
I just love that phrase, Big Gay. And they picked that up because, you know, some of us talk about things like Big Oil or Big Pharma, who really are big and have profound abilities to influence vast shifts in the economic well-being of this country. Big Gay we've got now. Can you, I mean, does that phrase Big Gay give you any sort of a mental image? When in fact there's nothing big about it at all. It is just a matter of ordinary workaday American human beings who would like to be afforded the same rights that are afforded everybody else under the Constitution, but at present they are not. Anyway, tell us, Brian. Tell us more about the Big Gay. How big? How big, Brian? This big? This big? That big? That big, Brian? When you're sitting there thinking, Big Gay,
Penalized by the state for running their businesses according to Christian conviction. And so we are hoping that Jan Brewer will sign this thing, both of the senators, John McCain, Jeff Flake. They're out there telling her not to sign it. You get a lot of pressure from Big Gay not to sign this thing. But again, you know, it's an illustration of the larger fact, ladies and gentlemen, I've said before, we are going to have to choose between homosexuality and religious liberty because we cannot have both.
Why not? I mean, that's just a naked, well, probably not the best way to say that. A bare, no, it doesn't work either. That's just an assertion that one cannot, and it's insupportable. It is argument, one cannot support it in argument, that their gayness does not account, cannot accord with freedom of religion. Because at one and the same time, if you say to Brian Fisher, proud son of Palo Alto, Well, Brian, there are lots of gay Christians. His answer, of course, is no, there aren't. They're not Christians. They're going to burn in hell because they're having sex differently from how my twisted reading of a bad translation of a 2,000 to 3,000-year-old text says, nope, God doesn't. Nope, not going to tolerate it. You're not going to have any. There are, God damn it, there are no disco balls in heaven. Right? So at the same time that he wants religious freedom, he insists on the right within that assertion to trample the religious freedom of others. So while he likes to talk about Big Gay, and one wonders, I personally would love to see the headquarters of Big Gay. I can imagine it's just a tremendous, tremendous edifice. It's got to be like one of the tallest buildings on earth, right? Because they've got so much power. They've got the gay agenda. They've got the ability to destroy the Constitution. I mean, is there like a Big Gay death ray? Or is it in our, is it in outer space? And it's able to destroy entire planets except for the fact that it's got, you know, one flaw that can be exploited by I don't know, Luke Straightwalker. Yeah. Yeah, see, bald assertion doesn't work either, Irish Dave. Then of course, Dan says, is that a Big Gay? Is that a subsidiary of Big Lubricating Oil? I mean, see, we don't know. Irish Dave pointing out, also, Andy Not-So-Breitbart named all his websites Big Fill in the Blank. Though he's still dead, maybe his heirs have set up BigGay.com? Nah, surely not. I mean, you'd have to hope that maybe... oh, for heaven's sakes. But we're not even, we haven't even gotten to the fun part of Brian Fisher.
Every advance of the homosexual agenda comes at the expense of religious liberty, and we're seeing that right now in Arizona.
Again, one of those bald assertions. We'll stick with that. Every advance in the gay agenda comes at the expense of religious liberty. No, it doesn't. Not at all. Because, see, freaks like Brian Fisher are free to sit at home and hate gay people until hell freezes over. And I mean, they can sing songs in their churches about how much they hate gay people. They can hate, and do it in the loving spirit of Jesus Christ. They're free to do that. Absolutely free. But what these theocratic Taliban Christians want is the ability to make the state behave according to religious principles. Or unprincipled, as the case may be. They want the right to enshrine their hate inside a secular government that they have decided that they despise. This is what you get out of the Christian Reconstruction and Christian Dominionist movements. And they're dangerous as hell. The fact that there's no less than four or five of these bills banging around out there tells you that this is a coordinated effort. Arizona, Kansas, Tennessee, Georgia. I guess it's been a while since I mentioned the Cold Civil War concept. Maybe it's time I mention it again, because this is a manifestation of it. These people are in open rebellion against the United States of America and we, the people, who are the guardians of that government. It's not the military. It's you and me. And see, for the most part, these goons have not yet taken up arms. But if you will read the constitutional definition of treason, you'll find that guns and shooting are not in the definition. Treason is the only crime that is defined within the Constitution of the United States. It was the only one serious enough that the framers felt like they had to take time to define in the enabling document of the Young Republic. Article 3 of the United States Constitution. Defines treason. Article 3, Section 3. Treason against the United States shall consist only in levying war against them or in adhering to their enemies, giving them aid and comfort. Well, does war necessarily... I think many of the great thinkers on conflict would suggest that we managed to wage war all over this planet long before the first gun was ever invented. Levying war against them, the United States, or in adhering to their enemies, giving them aid and comfort. Could we make the argument that, well, for instance, Iran is an enemy of the United States, so to speak. And Iran is a theocracy in which homosexuals are treated much the way Brian Fisher would like to treat homosexuals in the United States. So when Brian Fisher makes noises that sound exactly like the policies of Iran's mullahs with regard to gay people, isn't he, by definition, giving aid and comfort to an enemy of the United States, and thereby is Brian Fisher not committing treason? What, then, is the nexus between free speech and treason? If one commits treason but does so under the guise of religious liberty, do you get the get-out-of-treason-jail-free card because you've hidden behind the skirts of the church? These are serious questions. Do you suppose it gives comfort to a state like Iran that torments homosexuals, or a state like Russia that torments homosexuals, or a state like Uganda that torments homosexuals? Do you think it gives them aid and comfort when Brian Fisher talks about wanting to deprive people of their essential rights because of how he perceives they have sex? Or love one another? That's what we're talking about here. Brian Fisher, as much as we might like to just make sport of him, and we do, God, we do, Brian Fisher is, for all intents and purposes, a Lord Haw-Haw of the homophobic global right wing. He is a propagandist for theocracies, which by definition are inimical to the United States of America as it is established within our Constitution. And what these so-called religious liberties bills are and do is to attempt to subvert constitutional government in favor of a religious theocracy. No, a religious theocracy, that's kind of redundant, isn't it, Bob? Yes. So let's understand at its basic level that Brian Fisher is, with every word he speaks, essentially. And it matters not that he wraps himself in the flag and carries a Bible while doing so, while marching. He is essentially, quintessentially, un-American.
And Brewer will sign this thing, both of the senators, John McCain, Jeff Flake, they're out there telling her not to sign it. You get a lot of pressure from Big Gay not to sign this thing. But again, you know, it's an illustration of the larger fact, ladies and gentlemen, I've said before, we are going to have to choose between homosexuality and religious liberty because we cannot have both. Every advance of the homosexual agenda comes at the expense of religious liberty, and we're seeing that right now in Arizona. Either the homosexual agenda is going to be forced into retreat, or religious liberty is going to be forced into retreat, depending on whether Jan Brewer signs this bill or not. Now, we sent an action alert in. In fact, I did an interview this morning with a media outlet in Arizona because the American Family Association, we sent an email alert to over 31,000 people in Arizona that are a part of our email network urging them to contact Governor Jan Brewer and urge her to sign this thing for the simple reason that it protects Christians from discrimination.
Time out. Anybody at the IRS paying attention to this? Because this outfit is a 501c3 organization, and it's doing political lobbying. Anybody? I mean, just in case anybody's interested, there's a confession there.
Now, this bill is being talked about by Big Gay as if it enshrined discrimination, as if it was a bill that promoted discrimination. It does not do that. It doesn't promote discrimination. It doesn't cause discrimination.
No, because discrimination originates in the heart of the bigot. What it does is facilitate it. It ennobles it under color of law. Just as in the Deep South, Jim Crow laws